Chapter 8. Rodan got to wandering in the sagebrush. I would find the road occasionally, and then lose it again in a minute or so. I got to Carson about 9 o'clock at night, but not by the road I traveled when I left it. The general says my horse did very well for a while, but soon refused to lead. Then he dismounted, and had a jolly time driving both horses ahead of him, and chasing them here and there through the sagebrush. It does my soul good, when I think of it, until he got to town, when both animals deserted him, and he cursed them handsomely, and came home alone. Of course the horses went to their stables. Tell Sammy I will lay a claim for him, and he must come out and attend to it. He must get rid of that propensity for tumbling down, though, for when we get fairly started here, I don't think we shall have time to pick up those who fall. That is Stoddard's house, I expect, that Cousin Jim has moved into. This is just the country for Cousin Jim to live in. I don't believe it would take him 6 months to make $100, here, if he had $3,000 to commence with. I suppose he can't leave his family, though. Tell Mrs. Benson I never intend to be a lawyer. I have been a slave several times in my life, but I'll never be one again. I always intend to be so situated, unless I marry, that I can hull up stakes and clear out whenever I feel like it. We are very thankful to you, Pamela, for the papers you send. We have received half a dozen or more, and, next to letters, they are the most welcome visitors we have. Write oftener, Pamela. Dear Brother Sam. The house and Jim mentioned in this letter is the original of the character of Colonel Sellers. Whatever Mark Twain's later opinion of Cousin Jim Lambton's financial genius may have been, he seems to have respected it at this time. More than 3 months pass until we have another letter, and in that time the mining fever had become well seated. Mark Twain himself was full of the Sellers optimism, and it was bound to overflow, fortify as he would against it. He met with little enough encouragement. With three companions, in midwinter, he made a mining excursion to the much-exploited Humboldt region, returning empty-handed after a month or two of hard experience. This is the trip picturesquely described in chapters 27 to 33. Of Roughing It. It is set down historically in Mark Twain A Biography. Apostrophe Harper and Brothers. He mentions the Humboldt in his next letter, but does not confess his failure. To Mrs. Jane Clemens and Mrs. Moffat, in St. Louis. Carson City, February 8, 1862. My dear mother and sister, by George Pamela, I begin to fear that I have invoked a spirit of some kind or other which I will find some difficulty in laying. I wasn't much terrified by your growing inclinations, but when you begin to call presentiments to your aid, I confess that I weaken. Mr. Moffat is right, as I said before, and I am not much afraid of his going wrong. Men are easily dealt with, but when you get the women started, you are in for it, you know. But I have decided on two things, viz. Any of you, or all of you, may live in California, for that is the Garden of Eden reproduced, but you shall never live in Nevada. And secondly, none of you, save Mr. Moffat, shall ever cross the plains. If you were only going to Pike's Peak, a little matter of 700 miles from St. Joe, you might take the coach, and I wouldn't say a word. But I consider it over 2,000 miles from St. Joe to Carson, and the first 600 or 800 miles is mere 4th of July, compared to the balance of the route. But Lord bless you, a man enjoys every foot of it. If you ever come here to California, it must be by sea. Mr. Moffat must come by overland coach, though, by all means. He would consider it the jolliest little trip he ever took in his life. Either June, July, or August are the proper months to make the journey in. He could not suffer from heat, and 3 or 4 heavy army blankets would make the cold nights comfortable. If the coach were full of passengers, 2 good blankets would probably be sufficient. If he comes and brings plenty of money and fails to invest it to his entire satisfaction, I will prophesy no more. But I will tell you a few things which you wouldn't have found out if I hadn't got myself into this scrape. I expect to return to St. Louis in July per steamer. I don't say that I will return then, or that I shall be able to do it, but I expect to, you bet. I came down here from Humboldt in order to look after our Esmeralda interests, and my sore-backed horse and the bad roads have prevented me from making the journey. Yesterday one of my old Esmeralda friends, Bob Howland, arrived here, and I have had a talk with him. He owns with me in the Horatio and Derby Ledge. He says our tunnel is in 52 feet, and a small stream of water has been struck, which bids fair to become a big thing by the time the ledge is reached sufficient to supply a mill. Now, if you knew anything of the value of water here, you would perceive, at a glance, that if the water should amount to 50 or 100 inches, we wouldn't care whether school kept or not. If the ledge should prove to be worthless, we'd sell the water for money enough to give us quite a lift. But you see, the ledge will not prove to be worthless. We have located, nearby, a fine site for a mill, and when we strike the ledge, you know, we'll have a mill site, water power, and pay rock, all handy. Then we shan't care whether we have capital or not. Mill folks will build us a mill and wait for their pay. If nothing goes wrong, we'll strike the ledge in June, and if we do, I'll be home in July, you know. Pamela, don't you know that undemonstrated human calculations won't do to bet on? Don't you know that I have only talked, as yet, but proved nothing? Don't you know that I have expended money in this country, but have made none myself? Don't you know that I have never held in my hands a gold or silver bar that belonged to me? Don't you know that it's all talk, and no cider so far? Don't you know that people who always feel jolly, no matter where they are, or what happens to them, who have the organ of hope preposterously developed, who are endowed with an uncongealable sanguine temperament, who never feel concerned about the price of corn, and who cannot, by any possibility, discover any but the bright side of a picture, are very apt to go to extremes, and exaggerate with 40 horse microscopic power? Of course I never tried to raise these suspicions in your mind, but then your knowledge of the fact that some people's poor frail human nature is a sort of crazy institution anyhow, ought to have suggested them to you. Now, if I hadn't thoughtlessly got you into the notion of coming out here, and thereby got myself into a scrape, I wouldn't have given you that highly colored paragraph about the mill, etc., because, you know, if that pretty little picture should fail, and wash out, and go the devil generally, it wouldn't cost me the loss of an hour's sleep, but you fellows would be so much distressed on my account as I could possibly be if circumstances beyond my control were to prevent my being present at my own funeral. But, in the bright lexicon of youth, there's no such word as fail, and I'll prove it. And look here. I came near forgetting it. Don't you say a word to me about rains across the plains. Because I am down on that arrangement. That sort of thing is laid out, you know. The overland coach or the mail steamer is the thing. You want to know something about the route between California and Nevada Territory? Suppose you take my word for it that it is exceedingly jolly. Or take, for a winter view, J. Ross Brown's picture in Harper's Monthly of pack mules tumbling 1,500 feet down the side of a mountain. Why bless you, there's scenery on that route. You can stand on some of those noble peaks and see Jerusalem and the Holy Land. And you can start a boulder and send it tearing up the earth and crashing over trees down to the very devil, madam. And you would probably stand up there and look and stare and wonder at the magnificence spread out before you till you starved to death, if let alone. But you should take someone along to keep you moving. Since you want to know, I will inform you that an 8-stamp water mill, put up and ready for business, would cost about $10,000 to $12,000. Then, the water to run it with would cost from $1,000 to $30,000 and even more according to the location. What I mean by that is that water powers in this vicinity are immensely valuable. So, also, in Esmeralda. But Humboldt is a new country, and things don't cost so much there yet. I saw a good water power sold there for $750. But here is the way the thing is managed. A man with a good water power on Carson River will lean his axe up against a tree, provided you find him chopping cordwood at $4 a day, and taking his chalk pipe out of his mouth, to afford him an opportunity to answer your questions, will look you coolly in the face, and tell you his little property is worth $40,000 or $50,000. But you can easily fix him. You tell him that you will build a quartz mill on his property, and make him a fourth or a third, or half owner in said mill in consideration of the privilege of using said property, and that will bring him to his milk in a jiffy. So he spits on his hands, and goes in again with his axe, until the mill is finished, when lo, out pops the quantum wood chopper, arrayed in purple and fine linen, and prepared to deal in bank stock, or bet on the races, or take government loans, with an air, as to the amount, of the most don't care a-dash-dash-dun concern, that you can conceive of. By George, if I just had $1,000 I'd be all right. Now there's the ratio, for instance. There are 5 or 6 shareholders in it, and I know I could buy half of their interests at, say, $20 per foot. Now that flour is worth $50 per barrel, and they are pressed for money. But I am hard up myself, and can't buy, and in June they'll strike the ledge, and then who'd buy canary? I can't get it for love or money. $20 a foot. Think of it. For ground that is proven to be rich. $20, madam, and we wouldn't part with a foot of our 75 for 5 times the sum. So it will be in Humboldt next summer. The boys will get pushed, and sell ground for a song that is worth a fortune. But I am at the helm now. I have convinced Orion that he hasn't business talent enough to carry on the peanut stand, and he has solemnly promised me that he will meddle no more with mining or other matters not connected with the secretary's office. So, you see, if mines are to be bought or sold, or tunnels run, or shafts sunk, parties have to come to me and me only. I'm the erm, you know. How long does it take one of those infernal trains to go through? Well, anywhere between 3 and 5 months. Tell Margaret that if you ever come to live in California, that you can promise her a home for 100 years, and a bully one, but she wouldn't like the country. Some people are malicious enough to think that, if the devil were set at liberty, and told to confine himself to Nevada Territory, that he would come here and look sadly around, a while, and then get homesick, and go back to hell again. But I hardly believe it, you know. I am saying, mind you, that Margaret wouldn't like the country, perhaps, nor the devil either, for that matter, or any other man, but I like it. When it rains here, it never lets up till it has done all the raining it has got to do, and after that, there's a dry spell, you bet. Why, I have had my whiskers and mustaches so full of alkali dust, that you'd have thought I worked in a starch factory, and boarded in a flour barrel. Since we have been here there has not been a fire, although the houses are built of wood. They all are fire sometimes, though, but I am always too late to see the smoke before the fire is out, if they ever have any. Now they raised a yell here in front of the office a moment ago. I put away my papers, and locked up everything of value, and changed my boots, and pulled off my coat, and went and got a bucket of water, and came back to see what the matter was, remarking to myself, I guess I'll be on hand this time, anyway. But I met a friend on the pavement, and he said, where you been? Fire's out half an hour ago. Ma says Axtell was above suspicion, but I have searched through Webster's Unabridged, and can't find the word. However, it's of no consequence. I hope he got down safely. I knew Axtell and his wife as well as I know Dan Haynes. Mrs. A once tried to embarrass me in the presence of company by asking me to name her baby when she was well aware that I didn't know the sex of that phenomenon. But I told her to call it Francis and spell it to suit herself. That was about 9 years ago, and Axel had no property and could hardly support his family by his earnings. He was a pious cuss, though. Member of Margaret Sexton's church. And Ma says he looks like a man can't hold public office and be honest. Why, certainly not, madam. A man can't hold public office and be honest. Lord bless you, it is a common practice with Orion to go about town stealing little things that happen to be lying around loose. And I don't remember having heard him speak the truth since we have been in Nevada. He even tries to prevail upon me to do these things, Ma, but I wasn't brought up in that way, you know. You showed the public what you could do in that line when you raised me, madam. But then you ought to have raised me first, so that Orion could have had the benefit of my example. Do you know that he stole all the stamps out of an 8-stamp quartz mill one night, and brought them home under his overcoat, and hid them in the back room? Ears. Etc. Sam, a little later he had headed for the Esmeralda Hills. Sometime in February he was established there in a camp with a young man by the name of Horatio Phillips Raish. Later he camped with Bob Howland, who, as city marshal of Aurora, became known as the most fearless man in the territory, and, still later, with Calvin H. Higby, Cal, to whom Roughing It would one day be dedicated. His own funds were exhausted by this time, and Orion, with his rather slender salary, became the financial partner of the firm. It was a comfortless life there in the Esmeralda camp. Snow covered everything. There was nothing to do, and apparently nothing to report, for there are no letters until April. Then the first one is dated Carson City, where he seems to be making a brief sojourn. It is a rather heavy attempt to be light-hearted. Its playfulness suggests that of a dancing bear. To Mrs. Jane Clemens, in St. Louis. Carson City, April 2, 1862. My dear mother, yours of March 2 has just been received. I see I am in for it again with Annie. But she ought to know that I was always stupid. She used to try to teach me lessons from the Bible, but I never could understand them. Doesn't she remember telling me the story of Moses, one Sunday, last spring, and how hard she tried to explain it, and simplify it, so that I could understand it, but I couldn't? And how she said it was strange, that while her ma and her grandma, and her uncle Orion could understand anything in the world, I was so dull, that I couldn't understand the assayest thing. And doesn't she remember that finally a light broke in upon me, and I said it was all right that I knew old Moses himself, and that he kept a clothing store in Market Street? And then she went to her ma, and said she didn't know what would become of her Uncle Sam, he was too dull to learn anything ever. And I'm just as dull yet. Now I have no doubt her letter was spelled right, and was correct in all particulars, but then I had to read it according to my lights. And they being inferior, she ought to overlook the mistakes I make specially, as it is not my fault that I wasn't born with good sense. I am sure she will detect an encouraging ray of intelligence in that last argument. I am waiting here, trying to rent a better office for Orion. I have got the refusal after next week of a room on first floor of a fireproof brick rent, $1,800 a year. Don't know yet whether we can get it or not. If it is not rented before the week is up, we can. I was sorry to hear that Dick was killed. I gave him his first lesson in the musket drill. We had half a dozen muskets in our office when it was over Isbell's music rooms. I hope I am wearing the last white shirt that will embellish my person for many a day, for I do hope that I shall be out of Carson long before this reaches you. Love to all. Very respectfully, Sam. The nigh in this letter was his sister Pamela's little daughter. Long years after, she would be the wife of Charles 50. Webster, Mark Twain's publishing partner. Dick the reader may remember as Dick Hingham, of the Keokuk printing office. He was killed in charging the works at Fort Donelson. Clemens was back in Esmeralda when the next letter was written, and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.